It's us. We're here. We're sitting around talking movies with Bill Bregoli.
Yes.
And Bill McCuddy.
Is it really summer?
And I'm Neil Rosen. And we're going to talk about Me Before You this week, based on that famous romance novel. We're going to talk about Manhattan Night, a new movie with Adrian Brody.
Do we have to talk about that, except for the incredibly hot blonde woman in it?
New on demand and on DVD, Race, a biopic about Jesse Owens, the iconic Olympic athlete of 1936 Olympics. And we'll talk about Triple Nine, which has an all-star cast, including Kate Winslet and Casey Affleck and a whole bunch of other people.
Woody Harrelson.
We could go on. Who else? There's more people in that.
Sure, well,
Aaron Paul.
Anthony Mackie.
Yeah. And, just a lot of people. But anyway, we're going to start talking about Me Before You. Okay. So Me Before You is based on the popular novel by Jojo Moyes. And here's what it's about. It's a story about a small-town British girl played by Emilia Clarke from Game of Thrones who is hired to take care of a wealthy man who recently got hit by a motorcycle and became paralyzed from the neck down. And
it's Bridget Jones meets Ironside. And, basically, is the
Yeah, there you
with
go.
The rich English guy.
And he's played by Sam Claflin. And, Emilia Clarke, this is the first time I've seen her other than Game of Thrones. And she can't quite do this bright, bubbly, sunshine demeanor.
Like Sally Hawkins in Happiness. What was that called?
Yeah, that she's trying to pull off. And meanwhile, this Sam Claflin guy, despite being a quadriplegic, in every scene looks like he's stepping off the pages of some male model magazine, and they have no chemistry at all.
I'll be creepier. He kind of reminded me of, I shouldn't say this. Well, I'm going to say it. He kind of, because it's true, he reminded me of Christopher Reeve. Kind of looked a little like him, and he was running around in that
both performances
wheelchair.
Are very bad in different ways. She's over the top and annoying, and he's bland, and there's no chemistry, as I said, between them.
I hope we sat down and talked with them, and I hope they know that we feel this way before we roll that.
Makes the whole romance
but
thing
wait,
up.
Bill, did you see
yes,
this movie?
I saw the movie. I saw the movie with a huge group of recruited people who had won.
Audience extras.
Well, not quite. No, they had won a contest. From Hearst magazine.
Had they really, though, when you think about
this
the movie?
This was Marie Claire. Well, they got a goodie bag.
Oh, okay.
Containing handkerchiefs and, Kleenex. And,
oh, because it's a tearjerker.
And bumblebee tights, which figure into the plot.
And a bedpan.
There's a scene in the movie where, the boyfriend, Emilia Clarke has a boyfriend in the movie, and he's like a clod, he's a jock, and he completely does not pay attention to anything that she's interested in. He picks a vacation for her, which involves him doing a triathlon, and she's not even athletic.
Right.
And, it's so pathetic, the movie, in the sense that, even that is just so not subtle of,
Yeah, that's great.
Person who she's actually going out with doesn't understand her, but the guy that she's taking care of, he just gets her a gift and he just nails the gift that she likes. Why did she get so excited about the bumblebee tights? Oh, it's perfect. It's perfect. Bumblebee tights. I just love them.
Right.
Why was she so excited about that stupid gift?
Because she's a girl.
Because that was the first. She told him. You're really asking the question?
Yeah, but I'm saying she
told him she told the guy, the quadriplegic guy, that was the first thing she wore when she was
right.
Kid.
But I'm saying, I know why. I'm saying, why did she get that excited? I mean, it wasn't that phenomenal. Because you remember.
Bill, how would you say the movie played in the movie?
Do you understand?
In the theater
very,
with your recruited.
And I saw it with the recruited audience. It played very well. There was some weeping. There was a wail at one point. A woman, in the front. And
oh,
then
God.
The critic sitting behind me, a male critic, started to weep.
Really?
I got to tell you, I went with my wife.
You want to know, am I going to out somebody?
Yeah,
we
can't afford a lawsuit.
All right.
My wife and I went, and we liked it. I mean, it got to me. I will say that there are
really?
Everything you said on the show today. By the way, if you don't know, this is the after show for a thing called Talking Pictures, which is on the Time Warner Cable network, and is now the Spectrum network.
Well, soon to be. It's on Time Warner Cable nationwide, and it's locally on New York and New York One. And
so today you were trashing this movie, and I have to tell you that it's a sticky little scone that's not really as it's not really a great movie, but it pushes all the right buttons. It's got all the right numbers.
I'm agreeing with Bill.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. It hits all the numbers. It does what it's supposed to. And for one of these movies about essentially a tragedy and a sort of a sad state of affairs, there's a lot of humor in this. And I thought she was delightfully goofy.
Okay. She was annoying the shit out of me. And I got to tell you that I think as
you heartless bastard.
As somebody on our show said today, it's even insulting in some ways to.
To women with bad fashion sense?
No. First of all, okay.
Get that insulting thing when Lisa Rossman, who's on the show, brought it up. It's like, if I'm understanding her correctly, him making his own choice about what he wants to do, she's opposed to. And I don't want to give too much away.
There's a much better movie with a similar theme movie. It's a French movie called The Intouchables.
There's a much better movie for almost any movie
which is also about a wheelchair-bound person who it's a male aid. There's no romance involved in it, but he kind of gets him to enjoy life a little more. And I'm glad that there's no romance. It doesn't really matter because the romance in this didn't work at all for me. But what bothered me about this movie is the shift in tone. You're right, Bregoli. It's funny for a while and it's sweet, which didn't really work. But then it gets into this possibility of a euthanasia kind of theme. And that just does not sync up at all with the earlier tone of the film. And I think it's trying to be manipulative, and it did not affect me. And I'm a sucker for, you know, I'll cry at a drop of a dime, you know, in a movie. That's my DVD. Kevin, the producer walks in and hands me a DVD on a show, on a movie called 13 Hours.
That I'm fronting, that I'm talking about. So right. I'll get it to you.
Can I have
you
it can so actually I can come get to the information?
No, we'll deal with this after the show.
Unbelievable.
So anyway, this is a good movie if you want to see something with your wife or girlfriend.
Yeah, great date
that
movie.
She drags you to. You will not be disappointed.
Yeah. I agree with Bill, and I got to talk to the beautiful Amelia Clark.
Ah.
Yes, looked into those big brown eyes.
Was she wearing the bumblebee tights?
No, she was wearing a dress with spaghetti straps that kept falling down.
Oh, man.
And I could
first creepy Bill reference today.
We're starting with that. And she was sitting alongside Sam Claflin, and she says, apropos of chemistry, that the director, Thea Radick, I think her name was, had to hold them back because they were filming what they called the grumpy Will scenes, where his character is recently disabled and he's kind of grumpy and he just met her. And they were getting along, the two actors were getting along extremely well, and the director had to hold them back.
Thea knew that we had a good connection anyway, so then it was sort of, she would, in those early stages, she'd be like, hold it back, guys, like, hold it back.
I don't like each other yet.
Still having a good time. And then when we were allowed, it was like, yeah.
And we also talked to Jojo Moyes, who not only wrote the book, but got to do the adaptation, which doesn't happen all that often. Actually, they were going to get the people who did The Fault in Our Stars to do the adaptation, and boy, am I glad they didn't, because they would end up putting, what's her name in it? Who
was Shailene Woodley.
Shailene Woodley. This would have been set in San Francisco or someplace, instead of English people that Neil likes so much. But anyway.
I like English people. I like English people. But okay.
Anyway, so Jojo talked about what she did to adapt this novel into a book.
Yeah, I think the key thing when I was initially working on the screenplay was just trying to work out what was the essence of it and how we could strip away the superfluous stuff but still maintain the balance between humor and sadness, between the love story, which is at the heart of it, and the kind of subsidiary stories around it.
Do I think this is going to make a ton of money? I don't know. I'm not sure. It's certainly good counter-programming to things like X-Men and other the big mega blockbusters that are coming. But I think it is worth a look, and I think you're wrong. You heartless bastard, Neil Rosen, you English-hating, kidney pie-stomping, scone-slopping bastard.
Tea-drinking, crumpet.
No, tea-spewing.
Crumpet, get away.
Crushing.
You crumpet crusher, Neil Rosen.
Okay, I can give you a list of British movies, including Now look at this.
Yeah, apparently you can.
You got me all flustered. What's the one with the
Four Weddings and a Scone?
Bill Nye, Love Actually, is one of my favorite movies. It's such a great movie. You know?
I don't know where that heart was. I hear the heart that loved Love Actually.
I don't like
I don't
me
think,
before.
I think there was a transplant.
It's a bad Nicholas Sparks.
I don't know
Sparks.
What's happened.
It's a bad Nicholas Sparks movie, and has nothing to do with Nicholas Sparks, but it's that kind of genre.
Did you bring your wife?
No, I saw it alone. Bill McCuddy brought his wife. They were sitting in front of me in the screening.
Neil, if you were Lassie, I think you'd leave Timmy in the well. That's the heart I think we're dealing with.
So there's this movie that it's called Day and Date. It's in theaters and it's on demand simultaneously, and it's called Manhattan Night, and it's based on an author by the name of Colin Harrison, and he had an acclaimed novel. By the same name, and
actually, the novel was Manhattan Nocturne.
That's right. So, thank you, Bill McCuddy. This is kind of like it's set in contemporary New York, in the present, but it's like the style of it is like a '40s type of film noir. So I guess you'd call it like a neo noir. But it's that same style of '40s film with the narration of the hard-boiled cop going, I was pounding the beat at the newspaper and I ran into this game
reporter.
At a bar, you know what I mean? Yeah, he is a reporter. He's a New York City tabloid writer. And this beautiful woman who he meets, Australian actress Yvonne Strahovski, although she does an American accent in the film.
She's pretty stunning.
Yeah, he meets her and she tells him that this guy apparently solved some case that the police couldn't solve. Missing child doing his reporter duties.
She never really explains, but...
Yeah, so she
That's
says, my husband,
one.
Who was a filmmaker, was murdered, and asks him to kind of look into this. And then he's married. He has which is a very unusual... He lives in Manhattan. Did you see the movie?
No.
They walk down this alley, which is about maybe...
There are mews like this.
6 feet wide.
Would totally illegal. It's just
and
shoulder
then there's
wide.
There's a suburban house in the middle of Manhattan that's hidden down this alley.
Clapboard would be a better description. And there are some houses like mews down alleys in Manhattan, but this is not in Manhattan where they shot this.
So he's married to Jennifer Beals.
Jennifer Beals looks great, by the way.
She looks.
You were called out on the show for your chauvinism, rightfully
so. She's 52 and she looks terrific.
I can say just now that it's the guys here. Jennifer Beals looks amazing in this.
She does look amazing. And what's the matter with saying that? I got called out on the TV show by saying, I thought that she does look for 52. I think she looks terrific. And Campbell Scott in Flashbacks is the husband
who
was murdered. But he's, I think, very good. He plays this creepy maniac.
He's a filmmaker.
He's very abusive to his wife, played again by
Well, he's a prankster.
Yvonne
none of that
Strahovski.
Makes any sense to me.
And it's not worth full price at the box office, but if you like the style of this pulpy, hard-boiled type of movie for an inexpensive on-demand rental, I think it's worth a look. The plot kept me interested. I mean, is it a great movie? No, but I was kind of interested. And there's the guy
who makes a turn that's in this Rupert Murdoch-like publisher.
Yeah,
starts
he's the
barking
owner of the paper. And he
starts barking at him that he's in trouble, talking about the character played.
Yeah, who is that guy? That guy looks very familiar.
Yeah, he's been in some Guy Ritchie stuff, I think. He's got that look. I can't recommend this thing. I think it's a Manhattan night not well spent, and I would do something else.
Well, I don't know.
Which might include seeing Race, which is the other new thing that's big and did that misfire at the box office?
Yeah,
it wasn't
do very
huge.
Much at all.
No, it
this
really
is the
didn't.
Jesse Owens story, and I actually think they should have called it the Jesse Owens story or Race the Jesse Owens story or something that would have gotten that in the title.
Tell us what it's about, Bill McCuddy.
Well, it's about the great runner Jesse Owens and his life.
Owens,
thank you. And
it was the 1936 Olympics, and he broke the race barrier. And the 1936 Berlin Olympics during Nazi Germany. The big story on that is that Hitler snubbed Jesse Owens when he won 4 medals at that Olympics. He would congratulate everybody, but he refused to shake hands with a African-American athlete.
Well, that's what
athlete.
The movie tells us.
Right, but you know, right, I researched it, and apparently there's some discrepancy on that Owen said that it was not captured by film cameras and that he did shake Hitler's hand, and there was a photograph of it, which he carried around for 20 years, and who knows why you would carry around the photograph of you shaking Hitler's hand for 20 years. But if there was a photograph, that would disprove that there were cameras around, even though they weren't film cameras. They were.
So that doesn't work for the movie, but in real life, I remember hearing my whole life that Jesse Owens met Hitler.
No, I remember the whole story that he was snubbed. What did you hear, Bergoglio?
I heard that Hitler was kind of busy, and it wasn't like it was a purposeful snub. He just didn't shake his hands because it was a
big... Well, in the movie, they make it sound like he left early. He had traffic trouble, and he had to leave, which is lame. There's a lot of lame things in this movie, but as I said on the show, I'm more for renting it than against because it really is a great history lesson.
It is.
I didn't know, for example, that that fourth gold medal that he won was because the Americans pulled the two Jewish runners out of
the
relay
Nazis'
race.
Request,
at the Nazis' request. They folded to a kind of a weak subplot that involves Jeremy Irons'
character.
Okay,
I want to talk about that subplot. There's a subplot in this. At the beginning of the movie...
The remarkable picture of what they want, what the Germans wanted to
Jeremy
build
Irons,
in Washington, D.C., with in the shadow of the Washington Capitol. They wanted to put up this Nazi-like monument.
Yeah. Well, the Americans don't want to participate in the Olympics because of activities that are going on in the early 1930s by the Nazis in Germany and their... the way they're treating Jews and a lot of other things like that. So Jeremy Irons walks in with a list of demands saying, okay, do you want to really hold an Olympics without America in the Olympics? Here's what you got to clean up your act and you got to do this and you got to do that.
Take down propaganda posters.
Right.
And oh, by the way, stop rounding up Jews and taking them out of the city. And they agree, sort of.
Right. So he has all these demands and Goebbels goes, okay, tell them we'll meet your demands. So towards the end of the movie, and this is not a spoiler, when the Nazis want the after Jesse Owens wins three medals, hasn't done the fourth one yet, Goebbels wants the Jews on the American team to not compete in the Olympics, and Jeremy Irons says no way, and he goes well. I don't think if it comes out that you collaborated and we made a deal with the Nazis that that'll look. That'll bode too well for you. But Jeremy,
well, let's be specific about what deal you're talking about. They wanted to build a monument in Washington, D.C., and Jeremy Irons' character was a builder, and they were giving him that contract. And he said, okay, fine, I'll build your building in Washington, D.C. I'll build you. I got your building right here. I'll build your building. I'm thinking of the same joke I think you are, Jackie Mason. Every Jew knows a building. If they bought that building, they'd be rich today. Anyway, he agrees to build the building, and then it does seem like collusion. So at the end, Goebbels says, I don't think it's going to look very good if it comes out that—
I want to ask you, guess, what did you think of Jason Sudeikis as the coach?
I thought he loved him, and I thought he was completely miscast.
I didn't love him
at all.
Two other people. I thought he was miscast.
I thought he was in an SNL sketch.
Look, I'm not going to blame—
He wandered in from another movie.
Okay, look, you can't blame the guy for wanting to do a serious role and getting away from comedy, but the guy is predominantly a comedic character actor, and he's very good at that. What's that movie?
You know what
really
it reminded
like
me
Jennifer
of?
Jennifer Aniston.
It reminded me
where
of.
They're like they're all con people. They pretend to be a family with Sudeikis. And,
oh yeah, we're the Millers. That's funny.
That's very funny. Right. So who thought of Jason Sudeikis to play the Olympic?
Well, I'll tell you what
coach?
It reminded me of. It reminded me of Minor League or what's the Tom Hanks thing with Madonna and Rosie O'Donnell.
A League of Their Own.
Oh, that's
except
a great movie.
That worked great. So they took Hanks and they put him in sort of a serial comic
but
role.
But he was funny
and he
in
was
that.
Fabulous.
There's no crying
and
in baseball.
This is,
and...
Yeah, but this is the opposite. They put that same kind of funny guy in this thing that's trying to be a serious movie. It didn't work at all. Or I didn't think it worked as well.
Well, if you look at A League of Their Own, which to me is one of the greatest, if not the greatest sports movie ever made, I love that movie with...
Lori Petty, Tom Hanks, Madonna.
Yeah, but the one who's
Gina Davis.
Gina Davis, right?
I'll get to the one you're.
Yeah, but it you know looked at the female baseball league, which you know when all the men were off to war in World War II, they formed this thing. Gary Marshall plays this guy who's supposed to be Wrigley, but it's another gum company that's a fictitious gum company, and David Strathairn kind of like forms this league. I think that's a great movie, but Hanks is very funny in that movie. I mean, when he's yelling at the little
right.
kid, like one of them has a kid that's constantly on the bus, right? So Hanks gets to be serious, and he's a great actor, but he also gets to be funny. There's nothing funny about Sudeikis' performance. He's okay. He's perfunctory in the thing, but I don't really like him in the movie.
But again, I think there's enough in this film that's
the thing
new
I like,
and
yes,
interesting.
I recommend
not
the
new.
Movie.
Yeah,
here's what I like about the movie. It taught me some other things, too.
Exactly.
First of all, it was an interesting scene with Sudeikis when he goes to the Adidas factory and he wants to get sneakers, and they're rounding up Jews in the background and they're demanding his papers. But what I learned was that Leni Riefenstahl, who was Hitler's filmmaker, if I'm to believe the movie, and maybe it took a lot of license, maybe it's not that accurate, but according to the movie, she was more interested in telling the truth. They didn't want them to film Jesse Owens, the Nazis, winning because of the Aryan supremacy thing. But she's like, takes all the canvases off the cameras, is like, no, I'm doing this.
Well,
I'm a filmmaker.
They said, you're right, but let's tell the story right. They want to have this film done of it so that, as she tells him, tells Goebbels, your Olympics are going to be forgotten in a year. With my movie, they'll live on forever. So the Germans thought the Germans were going to win all the medals. That's why they agreed to do it. They built this unbelievable thing bigger than the LA Coliseum, and they're expecting to win everything. Now, as the Americans start to win, or specifically Jesse Owens starts winning everything, Goebbels is like, maybe we don't need to cover all of this.
Right.
Let's point the cameras at the Hindenburg
but
instead.
Which was also interesting.
But the movie wants us to believe.
The Hindenburg, it says the Hindenburg.
Yeah.
Hindenburg,
the movie wants us to believe that nobody was pro-Nazi. Like the broad jumper that becomes the friend, which actually turns out to be true at the end of the movie.
Well, Goebbels was
certainly
pro-Nazi.
No, yeah, but I mean, but like...
and Hitler was in the movie. He was certainly pro-Nazi.
That she was for it?
Right, I don't know.
The filmmaker?
Right, I don't know if that's true that Leni... I'm saying if you are to believe the way the facts
are
presented in the movie, Leni Riefenstahl is presented as a filmmaker, first and foremost, who puts her telling the truth and accuracy in her documentaries above...
Is she in Inglourious Bastards? Goebbels is, and the mother filmmaker is, but is she?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I think she is.
I don't remember.
Yeah,
I don't know, but she has a movie, a very famous movie called The Triumph of the Will, which is the very famous Leni Riefenstahl film, which is a pro-Nazi film. So I don't know how much I'm to believe in race that she was, as McCuddy says, she's painted in this as being like almost anti-Nazi.
Right.
And like, I've got to, then she has the scene with Owens. It's like, let's film some cover shots, to like make the thing look good. Isn't that cheating? Well, no, you were great. So I don't know how much of this is true and how much license was taken in the film, but I think it is worth a look, certainly on demand. I think you learn something, and not worth full price at the box office. And I think 42, which somebody, Rafer Guzman from Newsday, who was on our TV show today, said it reminded him of that movie. I think 42 with Chadwick Boseman is the better biopic. There are similarities, but I think this is interesting. I learned some stuff here, and I would recommend it. Which brings us to another movie called Triple Nine, which has this unbelievable all-star cast in it. I mean, the line we used on the TV show was like, what a waste of a cast here. I mean, you've got.
I saw the commercials for this, and my wife and I actually went to a movie theater to see it when it opened because it's got.
Did you follow it?
It's got. Mostly.
Hard to follow. Did you see it?
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of a Crash or one of those.
But did you follow the
plot? No, I didn't follow the thing. No,
it's so convoluted. I mean, it's like I didn't even care what was going on.
Kate Winslet. It's very believable. Kate Winslet is a Russian mob boss.
She's got the wig and the accent. And in the beginning of the movie, there's this scene when she opens the trunk of a car, and there are these people like gagged in a car, screaming and yelling. And she just kind of opens the car trunk and looks at it, and just closes the car trunk. And that, what did she throw?
Another
in the trunk?
Day at office.
What did she throw in that? She throws something in the trunk. I don't
remember. I mean, you got Woody Harrelson. You got
Casey Affleck. You've got Kate Winslet.
Chiwetel Ejiofor.
You've got Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad. You got Chiwetel Ejiofor. You've got
Anthony Mackie. Is it
Anthony Mackie?
There's another couple of other women too.
Yeah, there's a lot of people in this film, man.
There's a lot going on. This is the same guy, the same director who did The Road, which I liked with Viggo Mortensen. And I think when this director has a story with pared down characters, in the case of The Road, just two people, it works better. There's a lot of subplots
about this entire. At a certain point, I was like, I stopped like trying to figure it out.
It has a gritty, cool look, and I guess we should explain what 999 is. 999 is the call you make as an officer when another officer is down, and then all units respond.
Right.
So this would have us. Was it in Atlanta? I forget.
Yes.
This would have us believe that when an officer gets shot down,
the entire Atlanta
city drives over to
they
the factory.
They want to pull off a heist, right? But right, so they have to kill a cop, and they decide to target Casey Affleck, and
which is a good idea, just in general.
Yes, I'm not a big fan. So, although he wasn't so bad in this movie in terms of performance, but yes, so they decide. Right, as McCuddy says, the entire police force in Atlanta will be so preoccupied with this cop being killed that there will be no cops around, so that will give them the opportunity to pull off this particular heist.
Impossible.
Which also ties into something that Kate Winslet wants, where she wants to get her husband freed from a prison.
And then, they kidnap somebody's daughter. I mean, it's
God.
Got every
but
horry
here's the
device.
Twist, and I'm not getting, is that Casey Affleck. That goes wrong is they don't get to kill Casey Affleck, so the way we're describing it sounds kind of interesting.
Well,
but
it looks
it's really
cool,
not interesting.
But it's murky and hard to follow.
No, it's not good. It's not good. And I don't know last week at the box office. I want to just mention this. We talked last week on the show about Alice Through the Looking Glass, and which completely bombed at the box office. And as McCuddy said, there was a headline in Hollywood Reporter wondering if the tabloid news about Johnny Depp being physically abusive to soon-to-be ex-wife Amber Heard.
Amber Ka-ching Heard.
Oh.
Right. It was reflective of why that movie didn't do well at the box office. And I don't think it had anything to do with that. My theory is as follows. First of all, it got terrible reviews. And I think the fact that the original Alice in Wonderland movie did so well, which was directed by Tim Burton, is because it was the first 3D movie that came out, as I said, I think I said this last week on the show, after Avatar. And everybody was looking for that 3D experience. And Alice in Wonderland was not shot in 3D the way Avatar was, which is really an immersive, unbelievable example of how to use 3D in a film. It was just one of these quickie conversion jobs.
And this one didn't even bother to be 3D, right? Or right?
It was. 3D, yeah.
And everybody was kind of longing to see, let's see another great 3D movie. And I think Avatar was responsible to a large extent of this 3D craze, which
I hate.
The
popularity of that one. Yeah.
I also think all these 3D movies that have come out subsequently, I think Avatar is responsible. They make more money, the studios, but most of them are extremely disappointing.
Jungle Book is good.
Jungle Book is very good in 3D. Avatar is great in 3D. That movie that Martin Scorsese directed with Sacha Baron Cohen, it was
Hugo.
Hugo was good in 3D.
I thought you were going to come back to your Superman theory, which I think is truer, which is you can't make the same movie twice within the same period of time during the same generation. You're always talking about how they made the two Supermans too close to each other.
Made Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire, and then several years later, they went back to the well, cast Andrew Garfield because Sony was going to lose the rights to it, but instead of picking one of the tens of thousands of Spider-Man stories that you could pick from all these comic books, they decided to do this stupid...
So that's what
origin story
here.
Again about that, Peter that, Parker being bit by the radioactive spider.
I don't
spider.
Think we need two Alice looking
no.
glass.
I, my,
How do you like that movie?
My theory is that people who went to see the original Alice didn't like it all that much.
I
don't think people liked it. And when it came to chance to see another one, they said, "Nah, sorry, paid a lot of money, thought
I think
the first
that's
one
very true.
Would be good," and then it didn't bother.
I think that's true. I didn't care for it either.
So what's going to be the big blockbuster of the summer?
The big blockbuster of the summer. What's opening
Suicide
next?
Batman versus Superman is technically a loser at $890 million or whatever because it didn't make a billion.
I hope it's something without superheroes, but I don't know.
Captain America, Civil War made a lot of money.
Suicide Squad, yeah.
That's got a lot of buzz. I say
Captain America, Civil War might be the big money maker of the summer. If you were asking me for my opinion, that would be my opinion. But what's coming out, Bregoli? What's the big?
You throw it in my lap.
Yeah. What's the big? What's
nothing
the big
next
movie?
Week. There's not much that I can.
We're talking Genius next week on the show, which is about a literary movie, for all you literary fans out there, about somebody who worked for the Charles S. Scribner Publishing Company and discovered such writers as Ernest Hemingway and Thomas Wolfe.
And solved crimes in a cape at night.
And we'll also...
Had a secret lair.
And a pop star's opening this weekend. Sorry, folks, we haven't seen it. But you were going to make a comment about Popstar.
Well, one of our colleagues saw it and said it was okay, not great.
Right. Yeah, okay, not great. Well, Judd Apatow is a producer on it.
Has a ton of celebrity cameos, which I'm guessing is the Apatow part of the equation.
Andy Samberg, it's really a vehicle for him, and he co-wrote the thing. So
with his island, what are those guys called? The Deserted Island Gang or something like that?
Desert Island.
These are the guys that
do all the shorts.
YouTube videos before he
got
to
do the
SNL, so
the
video shorts. Yeah. So is that this crew?
Yeah. That's his gang. That's his posse.
All right. So anyway, anything else to talk about?
Oh, I wish there was.
Well, but I think we did it.
I think we did it, too. So next week we'll join you for Bill Bregoli, Bill McCuddy, and myself, Neil Rosen. Thanks.
Follow us on Twitter and send us some email. We'll answer your questions.
Yeah. You know, we have a Twitter feed, a Twitter account, which is Sitting Around Talking Movies. And we have a Facebook page, and you could write us questions. We would love to hear from you, because as Bill McCuddy always says...
No one talks to us. No. we watch the bad movies so you don't have to.
That's right, we do. So why don't you write us about some movies that if you agree with us, disagree with us, or whatever your questions, we'd love to hear from you. And we'll see you next week on Sitting Around Talking Movies.